I love this line at the end too. He says, as a bonus, you get to spend another week after all of this figuring out how to do regression testing so all future deployments don't have it again and no one accidentally reintroduces the bug. If you're lucky, you'll have someone report that one edge case later that you forgot to consider and then bundle it with a free consultation about how an ASM product can solve this problem for you. Hey guys, real quick, I just wanted to tell you about our sponsor, ThreatLocker. Now wait, before you hit the skip forward button, let me just say this. Most of the stuff that holds my attention nowadays is Red Team stuff as well. But I sat down with the ThreatLocker team this past week to do a demo of their EDR software, and it was super technically fascinating how this thing works. So check this out. You drop this thing on a system, right? And for the first week or so, it's creating a policy and a profile for that system. It's logging all the executables, what child processes are being spawned, the files and their hashes, that sort of thing. And it's creating this policy, okay? Then after the learning mode is up, we're in secured mode, and that policy gets put into place. And anything that's not on that allow list is immediately auto-denied. That's the zero trust piece, right? So in addition to that, they've got a bunch of crazy features like ring fencing and dynamic access controls that would stop a malicious hacker at pretty much every step along the way. Actually, I was watching this demo and I was kind of freaked out because I have no idea how I would cope with getting dropped into a ThreatLocker system as a red teamer. Anyway, if you want to learn more about this, head over to threatlocker.com and request a demo. And when you do, ask for my boy Andrew. His demo was super to the point and he was able to answer all my technical questions. All right, cool. Back to the show.
Man, if only the audience knew the blooper that we just
oh,
had.
Oh man, that blooper. We're going to have to send that one to the critical thinkers, I think. So anyway, let me get back to the subject matter. I'm prepping for this DEF CON talk right now. And essentially, it is a summary of all of the crazy bugs I've found within the past couple of years. And dude, that memory of me and you popping that router, that was the best, man. That was such a fun bug.
I'm really excited to see what you're able to ask. Well, maybe not what you're able to, but what you're going to say about that.
Yeah, dude, I have like this meme of you. And you know, like, I want to say it was probably when, like, oh, man, I think it was when HackerOne did like a photo shoot in like the streets of New York back in the day. Yeah. And you've got your like hood up and your glasses on and you just look so badass.
And there's a picture of Andre from that same photo shoot. We posed next to like the same sign.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. Somewhere there's a Xerox ACB photo as well.
I have to say that photo shoot that HackerOne did with y'all was like one of my like core motivation features. You know, like I saw that and I was like, I have to become a live hacking event hacker. Like
that's awesome.
It is my fate, and voila, here we are.
Here you are, manifest.
Indeed.
That's all right, awesome. Man.
All right, so. We got a couple things to hit today before we talk about our primary topic, which is less writing, more hacking, essentially how to write reports quickly and well for bug bounty programs. And I've got a tool I'm going to release with this. So should be pretty
fun. This is awesome.
Yeah. I normally drop these things first to the critical thinkers, but this one I was like, you know what? I'm going to just drop this one for everyone this time.
Yeah. I saw these links in the doc and I was like, is this like new? Yeah. Like, what is this?
That is, man. I just got it PR'd into the project, but we'll talk about that in a second.
Awesome.
News. Really cool thing happened this week. I saw a post on Twitter from the RCE man, and then I saw Gareth Hayes comment on it with two chilling words. Nice research! !
Underrated reply.
Seriously. And when Gareth, you know, when that's coming from Gareth, it's like, okay, we done something right, you know?
Yeah.
And this was the tweet regarding essentially XSS WAF bypasses by using multi-character HTML entities. And from what I can tell, there's just like a bunch of entities that I didn't know existed, like the ampersand, and then you do some, you know, ASCII string, and then the semicolon, and if that is being interpreted by the server, and getting HTML decoded, Even if it's like checking for less than or something like that, there are some weird attributes like ampersand NVGT or ampersand NVLT, which will convert into the less than and greater than signs plus some other Unicode character.
Yeah, I thought this was I've never heard of these, by the way. And I don't know if you saw, there was actually a second reply that Garrett sent to this tweet which was a link to Shazzer, which is a tool that we talked about last week. And well, actually, the initial reply is broken, but he followed up with a new fuzz on it. But Gareth added a fuzz to Shazzer that tests for this specifically and finds all of the ASCII or URL encoded values that'll work
super
in,
fascinating
in JavaScript URLs, which is great. So that now you know like what things you can put in there that will actually work and bypass there.
Yeah, no, it seems really rad. And essentially, it looks like he just kind of hit it with, I'm not actually sure where he's getting the source for all this, but there's a bunch of different strings you can put in between those, the ampersand and the semicolon sign. And it's interesting, though, because that, if you use the one that he mentioned in the tweet, it becomes a less than and a string, like a Unicode string, right? So it's like, I'm not sure if this is actually gonna, because that's not a valid tag, right? So
yeah,
the less than one is a little bit like, I mean, maybe it would work in those scenarios where HTML, like you're able to trigger an XSS using any HTML attribute. Like there's some stuff in the PortSwigger XSS cheat sheets that's like, you know, this on-click handler or whatever will work with any element, and they always just use the XSS element or whatever. So it might work in that scenario, but the one that I'm more excited about is the ampersand NVGT semicolon entity, and that one will do the greater than sign, which will allow you to close off tags, which could be really, really helpful.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, so this is super, super cool. I love this kind of research. I'm sure that there are probably some other instances of this as well. The Shazzer thing from Gareth is actually specifically for URLs. So one example that he showed is that if you do like an Ahref with JavaScript colon one and hat semicolon alert one, then that will like work, I guess. So that's just like a very interesting bypass. There's a lot of these characters and HTML encodings that seem to work. So I definitely recommend taking a look at
that one was kind of interesting. I wasn't sure. I'm not sure about that one. I want to go and actually check and see if that works, because that doesn't make a lot of sense to me that it would work with that. With, you're talking about the one with the JavaScript URL?
Yeah.
That one, I don't know about that one. Like I see that he put that in there just to kind of smuggle in the J character or whatever. But I think that might only be in some niche scenarios where it cuts off the first string. But if it actually does work, that would be nuts.
Yeah. I don't know. It's super weird.
Yeah. So actually, you know what? Let's just check it out right now. Hold on. Let's just do the nerd snipe. Hey guys, real quick, I just wanted to give a shout to the Hacker Content team. They have been absolutely killing it the past couple months, taking the content from the podcast and condensing it down into consumable social media posts, whether it be shorts or text posts or whatever. They've been rocking it. So I just wanted to give them a shout out and let you know that they do all sorts of cybersecurity content as well as social media management. They do technical blogs. They do comprehensive social media management. So if your organization could benefit from any of those types of services, make sure you head over to hackercontent.com, drop them a line, and mention the podcast when you do to get your first month of cybersecurity content marketing services for free. All right, that's it. Let's get back to the pod. No way. Okay. You can. That was crazy. Okay, that does actually work. Hold up. This is way cooler than I thought it was. So this payload, like, so you're assigning this to location.href via an onclick handler in an A tag, right? Yeah. And it's ampersand FJLIG semicolon AvaScript alert one, right? And that character is supposed to convert to FJ, I thought, when HTML decoded. And I was like, so what is that going to work? Like, why is there an F just in front of the JavaScript scheme? But for some reason, this actually works, where if you look at the actual href, backslash F J A V A S C R I P T, just normal JavaScript, colon, alert one, it pops, dude. Mind super absolutely blown.
Interesting. And yeah, because backslash F must get converted to a special character. I wonder exactly if there was like a, yeah, if you had like a T as well, like there's a variety of different characters that would fit that criteria that would probably get ignored or something.
Yeah. Wow. Very interesting. I guess you're right. I guess it gets converted, like backslash F gets converted to something that,
yeah, it gets converted, actually, like the backslash stays, so it becomes backslash FJ, and then the J becomes backslash F JavaScript, and then the backslash F is like, must be some special character or something that's getting ignored. It doesn't seem like it's anything special, but it must be ignored because it's escaped or something. I know that there are definitely cases like that, like in JSON decode and stuff, where backslashes get ignored. So it could be something similar like that. But yeah, that's really interesting.
Look at this. So,
and because it's a location, it's like an on click on the A ref. So it's not, it doesn't look like a link, but it's like clickable elements.
Yeah. That's crazy, dude. So I'm looking at this and I looked it up. Backslash F is a form feed character to indicate that a printer should start a new page. So it's like some legacy printer version of backslash N. Which, of course, if you have that before the JavaScript scheme, it does work. Very interesting. Well, that research is a lot more interesting than I realized when I put it in this in the podcast notes. So if that's you haven't already, definitely go check out that post by the RCE man, Anton. We'll link it in the description below. Wow. Kind of mind blown at this point.
Yeah. Super cool. Super, super cool.
All right. Let's go ahead and move along. I'm still a little bit stunned, honestly. That's really, really interesting. Let's go ahead and move along to the next one, though. This was some research that came out this week. Next.js cache poisoning. And you can read through it. And it's, I mean, there's definitely a good technical write-up in here. But here are some of the takeaways I had from this, okay? One, I think cache poisoning might be the new, like, subdomain takeover.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, subdomain takeovers, super duper competitive nowadays. And the recon boys, so to speak, are having to pivot into different attacks, different attack vectors to, you know, spray across a mass scale. And I think that the best way, that this might be one of the best ways to make money through mass automation at this point, is mass scanning for cache poisoning. And I'm looking at, because I'm looking at this write-up this guy did, and he made a chunk. I mean, there are probably 20-something reports here, at least, that he associated with this one bug, all paid out and accepted and triaged just from this one thing. So I think cache poisoning could be the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, so I think we're definitely seeing sort of the pivot. I mean, automation has always been like a very fluid sort of thing where it depends on like what's exploitable in mass and what there's a lot of and like where the competition is and like how to get that edge and stuff. And so you've definitely seen like subdomain takeovers sort of being starting to be solved as a systemic problem where all the providers who are vulnerable to subdomain takeover are implementing methods where like they're no longer vulnerable to it, because I think their customers are complaining about it.
Yeah, I would be too.
Lots of reports and stuff. So you know, because when you get a subdomain takeover for a third party product, you're gonna reach out to that third party and say, hey, like we have this issue, like how do we fix it, right? So you know, it makes sense. But yeah, you're definitely seeing this shift where now like subdomain takeovers are starting to get harder and harder and more competitive, and it's like a super fast race to claim it first and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, when you pivot to a more complex vulnerability or something that's a little more technical, you get that edge and
you do.
It's much better payout.
And I think the cache poisoning, the beauty of the cache poisoning thing is it's something you can validate pretty easily automatically, right? Like if I add this header, does the response drastically change, you know? I think that's pretty validatable. And I know that there are a lot of people doing cache poisoning at scale already. I've had some good conversations with people about that and building out automation and making quite a bit off of it. So definitely something to look at there for anybody who's big into the recon space. Other takeaways I had from this was just get the code base for whatever, you know, technology you're trying to look at, and just grep for headers, grep for, you know, X dash or whatever, right? And any mention of customized headers within these sort of frameworks and something like that, there's a lot of possibility. I think that's a really interesting attack surface that's kind of underestimated, because a lot of times we're looking for, you know, parameters and trying to trace the data as it flows through query parameters or body parameters or whatever, or JSON blobs, but we're not necessarily thinking about, okay, wait, I can also trace my input from custom HTTP headers. So that's definitely another attack surface to keep your eye on. And then the next one was, I just love this quote from this write-up. It says, quote, "The application was cache poisoning itself." And so the devs added this cache buster. And I think that that's a really good takeaway from this, right? Is if you see a cache buster anywhere, the application was likely, you know, cache poisoning itself, and the dev is like, oh, how do I fix this? Ah, cache buster, right? You know, and so I think that's always a good place to look for those vulnerabilities.
Well, and it's also like, again, pull down the source code and look through some of that stuff. Go back. One thing I love to do is, if there's something like a cache buster, for example, and you notice there's a cache buster, on GitHub, click blame. There's a little button for it. Okay. And it's a git blame. It sounds a little more mean than it is, but really what it is it's a log of every line in the code, who committed that line. And you can go and you can view the commit. So you can see, okay, the line that added this cache buster was from this commit. You go to that commit, you see what PR it came from. It was probably the commit that went and fixed that original cache poisoning. Now you go and you look and see, okay, where was this affecting? Where did they fix this? How do they fix this? Yeah. Is there a bypass?
Or what I thought you were going to say was, you run a git blame, you find the developer that did that shit, and then you look at them? Everything else that they've ever written in that code base. Wow. And be like, all right, let's just pick on this guy.
God damn, Justin.
That's hilarious.
Justin's a savage. Justin's like, I want to take this person and make their life horrible.
Can you imagine?
I want to find every mistake they ever did.
If it's like, if you just did that to one developer. and like, you just submit like 15 bugs and they're all from this guy's code base.
That's so mean. You're just like, I just noticed that John Smith committed this.
Yeah, your enemy is like, you know, a dev on an open source project or something like that.
And you're just like tagging him on every issue you file. Yeah,
you're going down.
So speaking of things at scale, you saw this tweet from Nagli, right?
Yeah, dude. Okay. So that was kind of a weird situation. I want to get your take on this as an AppSec guy. Okay. So Nagli tweeted out this nuclei template about how exactly to scan for this sort of polyfill IO domain takeover that occurred. And it's crazy because I've seen polyfill IO everywhere, man. And essentially the situation with this was that domain got sold to bad people, essentially, and now they have like a backdoor on every website that's ever used polyfill.io, which I feel like there needs to be some sort of like regulation surrounding this at the domain level. You know, my American is screaming right now saying freedom, blah blah blah, but like, man, if you have a domain that is so widely used in so many ways, there needs to be some sort of transfer system or surrounding that applied at the domain level, because man, just transferring that away to rogue actors gave a backdoor into like a ton of websites.
Yeah, it's super super wild. It's really interesting. So, well, one thing I was thinking about recently is that there's a new PCI requirement for anybody who deals with PCI and stuff, but one of the PCI requirements is that there you have to have change and tamper detection on payment and checkout pages, and not in the sense of like monitoring for code changes, but monitoring for dynamic changes, like the scripts that are loaded that are not expected, or that they have changed signature and stuff. And I think that's a very interesting call out in retrospect on like this sort of vulnerability, because if any company that has that sort of monitoring would probably have noticed this. So it's just something, you know, very interesting that I was just thinking about the connections between the two of those and you know, how it would have played out from sort of like an AppSec perspective. But yeah, as a whole, I mean, these types of things are like very difficult to find and detect. Like even what I just like mentioned of like monitoring for dynamic script execution on a website, it's a very difficult thing to do. Like you basically have to, you know, use like some headless browser or something like that to, you know, load the page, and then somehow you have to hash it. And like, yeah, dude, it's, you know, it's a very,
that's a pretty interesting sort of business idea, isn't it? Like monitor the upcoming changes to PCI compliance specs. Like
I promise it exists. Don't worry.
And like say, okay, oh, they're going to like make this requirement for us to have this headless browser that does change monitoring or whatever. Here's your,
I promise, your solution. If you search PCI 11.6.1,
yeah,
you'll get, there's like at least five or six companies that are doing exactly that.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Look at that. Wow. Crazy. Yeah. Well, but I mean, like in the future, it's kind of an interesting thing. Like I'm sure there will be changes to the PCI spec in the future.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that they goes through like a review process first, where in that those reviews are public. So as soon as that gets released and there's a new requirement in place that requires some sort of technical solution, getting a head start on devving that and reaching out to organizations that are going to need it, I think that's a really great business model.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, so it was interesting to see that Noggly released a nuclei template for that. That definitely helps. I don't know that, I mean, and he's kind of doing it related to Shockwave. I don't know that that would result in bounties. What do you think about that, Joel?
Yeah, so I don't, like, just simply pointing it out is one of those things that, I guess it depends on the program. Like some programs will probably like, maybe as a thank you if they didn't know or something. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling it's probably also maybe one of those things where the platforms would like potentially argue that it's like a zero day or something like that. I don't know. I think it's definitely like a nice thing to do, but you probably shouldn't expect a bounty. Like, you know, if you have the automation set up, like I can see for somebody like Nagly that it's a good business proposition to be like, hey, I'm not expecting a bounty. Just want to let you know I have this software called Shockwave. It detected, you know, this vulnerable software on your website. You may want to fix that. Also, if you want to sign a contract, here's my email. Like, you know, and like do something like that. But
it adds
that's
value.
Kind of a unique
and
angle,
man,
right?
He's on top of all these things, dude. He pinged me a couple days before the Magento thing hit the public and was like, hey, this is gonna be crazy. And he's got a good feed on that. So
he's got his finger on the pulse. Yeah,
yeah, nice. It's pretty good for Shockwave. What's this other thing you got on here, man?
Okay. Yeah. So, okay. So Sean Yeo, you know, friend of the pod, he tweeted out this amazing, blog that he wrote, I guess. And it's titled, Hey, why can't I get, what was the title again?
Hey, why can't you fix this one bug?
Yeah. Hey, why can't you fix this one bug? And it basically chronicles a researcher, being like, you know, imagine you're a security researcher, you scan the internet, you find this endpoint on some company, you submit the bug hoping for, you know, easy money. And then you're like, why can't the developer just remove the route? And it's a walkthrough of like the other side of the conversation. And it's such a great blog. You know, we've definitely had this conversation multiple different times, but I think this does a great way of illustrating it in more depth on sort of a generic level. Of what it's like being a security engineer and like the process that you go through and the days turn to weeks, turn to, you know, whatever, as you're just trying to like figure out how to fix this and who owns it and where it is and what the issue is. And meanwhile, all the researcher sees is like, hey, where's my bounty, bro? Like,
you just remove the route.
They're like,
please?
Why can't you just remove the route? And the researcher, I think a lot of the time researchers, like they think that every website is just like a, you know, 30 lines of Flask code and like a Python file. And they're just like, what do you mean? There's just a route handler. you just like highlight 15 lines of code, you press delete, and then you save and you rerun the Python file.
Exactly.
Like, I don't, like, what's the big, this shouldn't be this hard.
I was reading through this and I was like, man, this is absolutely me. Like, I'm going through here, and you know, every step along the way, he's like talking about all this like L7 load balancing and like Lambda this and blah, 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 that. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I consider myself pretty like familiar with, I guess, application architecture and stuff, but like, nah, I only know it from the outside, man. I only know it from the outside. And it seems like this is a really interesting read for me, because there's so much more to it than I anticipated. And you know, at one point somewhere in here, he says like, you know, oh, I figured out sort of roughly where it is, but wait, I can't touch that. I don't have privileges to touch that. Yeah. And can I get a dev to touch it? Not a chance. It's Q2, you know, like nothing happens in Q2. And I'm like, what? How does this?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. It's so real. It's so real. So I would recommend anybody who's just, I'm sure everybody's had this thought at one point. That's like, why can't they just remove this? Like, what's taking so long? Whatever. Read through this blog post. It's a short read. It's easy to read. It's a good read. It'll definitely put you in the mindset of like what it's like to be a security engineer. And then I would recommend that anytime you're like, what is taking this team so long? Just pull this up, read through it, and be like, oh yeah, that's why.
Yeah. I love this line at the end too. He says, as a bonus, you get to spend another week after all of this figuring out how to do regression testing so all future deployments don't have it again and no one accidentally reintroduces the bug. If you're lucky, you'll have someone report that one edge case later that you forgot to consider, and then bundle it with a free consultation about how an ASM product can solve this problem for you.
I did not even play that. I didn't read that end part. That's so funny.
Which is like has Noggly. Liz, I love how we put that right after our segment on Noggly too.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's great.
Anyways, well, this is a great blog from Sean. So go check it out on his blog. I think this is a new blog for him. Mewy.pw, M-E-W-Y. But yeah, we love Sean.
Yeah, Sean is great, dude. Yeah, wow, that's hilarious, man. All right, so let's get to the topic matter for this week. And I guess I'm gonna go ahead and start with what's down towards the bottom of the doc, Joel, which is,
sure,
lately I've been thinking, okay, AI, right? Lately I've been thinking, Justin's just kind of sitting there in the hot tub. AI.
I told Justin yesterday that if he had any ideas for how to do something related to the podcast, he should write it down. And he's out here thinking about AI instead. Yeah.
No. I was sitting in the hot tub thinking about AI, not those things. So as I was sitting in the hot tub thinking, AI, like, as I do, you know, I'm thinking, what are the ways that this can apply to bug bounty hunting and hacking? And there's a lot of applications that kind of pop into the brain. But what large language models are best at is dealing with text and human parsable text, really. They do great work with code and stuff like that too, but mainly writing and generating text is what it's great at. When do we have to generate text in the bug bounty flow? For the report.
At the worst part. I'm not gonna lie. I literally, like, writing reports is, it pushes me over the edge sometimes.
It's bad, man.
Like, I'll find something and I'll be like, is it really worth my time to write this report? No.
Is it worth writing the report? Well, see,
even if I find something critical, I'll be like, now I have to write this up.
Okay, so I do not have that
problem. Try and explain
if it's
this.
If it's a critical, I'm normally like super hyped to write the report. I'm like, let me show them how I like did this and I like bypassed that. And I'm like, wee, wee, wee. Like, you know, like, that's what's happening in my brain.
That was like a little snapshot inside Justin's brain for a second.
But what I don't love writing is those stupid like reflected XSS reports. I'm like, okay, here's a quick little reflected XSS. Like, you can just grab the token and get, you know, account takeover or whatever. So it's like, there's not like this whole like technical thing. Normally, if there's some cool flow where I like do this OAuth thing and like grab the code and get ATO, then it feels a little bit more fulfilling. But when it's like super basic, it's just really annoying. So
let's start with that, right? Like the first tip and the thing that I always like, and I know you have something for this, is report templates, right? I know HackerOne has this natively.
Yeah.
I assume BugCrowd and the other platforms probably do to some extent. If not, just keep a folder on your on your computer and probably put it on GitHub, which Justin.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Talking about this repo.
Which, So listen, here's the thing about the report templating thing, okay? I do have a repo, github.com/generator/reports, that is essentially a report templating software that I used back in the day when I was doing a bunch of automation stuff and I was just submitting the same bones over and over and over again. Subdomain takeover, blah, 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 blah. Then, you know, take the domain, run a dig plus trace on it, take the output, put it in the report, that sort of thing, right? And it's written in Python 2.7. It's not very long. Wow. I didn't even, because
I'm not going to roast you. It's okay. It's old.
Dude, here's the thing though. Like I started writing Python when I was 12, you know, and around that same time was when they made the transition to Python 3.
Yeah.
Right.
And people don't realize both how old and how young Python is. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I, at that point, you know, I was a young guy and I was like, I kind of got my head into the Python 2.7 ecosystem. I was more of a programmer at that point than I was a hacker. I was just loved programming with Python. And I was very against the Python. I mean, there was a whole sort of resistance movement against Python.
Me too,
3.
Man.
Like,
I was
so
you mean
bad.
I got to put parentheses around my print
exactly.
statements
now? Exactly. It was so infuriating. Like, why would you make that change? Like, it's ridiculous.
In hindsight, though, I was like, yeah, that was such an outlier. Like, why? Yeah. Why wasn't there friends?
We don't need that. All we need is our youthful rage, Joel, at the system. Anyway, so I held off on switching to Python 3 for years, and then I finally have. And you know, now I'm thinking, okay, now I need to learn how to write Rust or Go or whatever. So that's going to be on my. What did you say the other day that I didn't know the H2 or?
H2 yeah yesterday I was like it's the start of H2 and you were like what's H2 and I was like it's the second half of the year.
It's like corporate speak, man. I don't know that. I mean, I barely know what quarter are we in right now. Like
three,
right?
Exactly. Q3 just started.
Thank you. So anyway, that's on my 2025 H1 there we go goals, learning to write Rust or Go, one of the two. But okay, let me just finish this segment, Joel.
Yeah, sorry, I'm derailing you really
no,
hard.
No, you're good. So essentially, we have this github.com/reinerator/reports repo. It's written in Python 2.7. Literally just handed to ChatGPT and converted to Python 3. I didn't get the chance to do it before this episode. It's very simple. All it does is just takes your markdown, parses out the templates, allows you to run to provide like variables into the templates and also run commands on the command line. So you can automatically insert stuff like, you know, dig commands and then the output from the dig commands into the report. Super helpful. That really helps. But here's what I was going to say before, which was I have a tool now to write the reports using AI. So essentially what it does is it uses this really cool framework called Fabric from Daniel Meisler, okay? And I actually, in the doc, I've got my own fork of it listed here, but it actually got merged into main yesterday. So essentially what Fabric is it's a way, the way he describes it is it's a way to augment humans with AI. Essentially, it's a framework around collecting prompts, or they call patterns in this specific environment, and allowing you to very easily send data to that via standard in typically and get the results passed to AI. So you can pass it to ChatGPT, you can pass it to Claude, you can pass it to your own Ollama server. There's lots of cool stuff that's built into there. You can have it have context about you as a person.
CD in Ollama, by the way. So.
Oh, is there
don't,
really?
Don't expose your Ollama to the network, but
oh, really?
And make sure it's up to date. But yeah, there was just a CV in Ollama recently.
I think Ollama would be a really interesting thing to go after because they've got like role-based permissions and stuff like that too. You can have like users and admins and that sort of thing. But I wrote this pattern called write _hacker1_report. And essentially what it does is you can provide it with an input that contains requests, responses, and then comments. And it will take that and can take into consideration your comments, look at the request and the response, and write a report for you based off of that. That fits the HackerOne sort of model, right? You've got like the summary, the details, the steps to reproduce, and the impact, and like, you know, various supporting resources and that sort of thing. And so in order to get everything in the right format for all that, I wrote this other tool called BB Bug Bounty Report Formatter. That's on github.com/ReinerIter/BB Report Formatter. And essentially what that does is it allows you to just very easily send in requests, send in responses, send in comments, and it'll store them in your on your local system. And then whenever you tell it to, you can just do use --print-report, and it will dump out the report structure. And then you can just pipe that right into Fabric, write HackerOne report, and it will generate the AI-based report. Now, here's the question. I know it's in your head, Joel.
Okay.
It might be in your head, might not be in your head. Does it actually freaking work?
What?
And the answer to
the
that...
The only thing that's been in my head... Okay, does it work? We'll finish. I'll let you finish.
The answer to that is sort of.
Oh, no.
So it works really well with ChatGPT 4.0. Or for Omega or whatever. Yeah.
The new one.
Yeah, the new one. It gets great results. I gave it a vuln that I had from before that's already closed. And it wrote an awesome report for it. Easy peasy. I just gave it the request, the response, and some description of the vuln, and it took it away.
Okay.
But the goal with this whole thing was to be able to do this with private AI, to be able to do it with Olama on my local system so that it doesn't leak the...
As...
Yeah. So that it doesn't like leak the report contents to OpenAI, and that does not work quite as well. It works pretty poorly, actually. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting edge case. I'm still going to release the tool because some people will use it with ChatGPT, and that's fine. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing progress in private AI because this really highlighted for me the difference between a system that like ChatGPT's stuff and something like Olama using like Llama 3 or Llama 2 model.
Right.
I mean, the results were just drastically different.
Yeah. Super interesting. One thing I did want to mention, and this is completely... This is like the totally wrong takeaway. I'm so sorry. Okay,
What is going on today, man?
Okay, I'm just sorry. You said that to convert Python 2 to Python 3, you should just throw it in ChatGPT.
What are you talking about?
Okay, there's a built-in tool. Okay, if you don't know this, there's a built-in tool in Python. It's called 2-3. Number two, number two, word two, number three.
What?
2-3, and it converts Python 2 scripts to Python 3.
No, it does not. In.
It does. That's what it did. Search it up. 2-3. Anyways, I'm just leaving that there. It exists.
Wow. Check that out.
It's pretty cool.
All right.
It's getting removed in like version 3.13 or something.
Oh, really?
But like if you haven't converted your Python stuff by now. You
know, whatever. Very cool.
But yes.
I was gonna be mad at you, but that's actually really cool.
Yes, for that is like the one case where I'll say you don't need to use ChatGPT for this. You can use something much less AI that will probably not get it start hallucinating halfway through your script.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Very cool. Someone should do that. Maybe I'll do it afterwards. Maybe I'll do it before this podcast airs. Who knows? I got a lot of stuff on my plate this upcoming week, but it would be interesting. The takeaway there though is really worthwhile to have some sort of templating system in place. And I just kind of use the HackerOne templates and use some of the AI stuff that I've built in now. But I think, you know, before when I had this more advanced templating system, especially if you're reporting very similar bugs time and time and time again. It's very helpful. And I recently had a scenario where I had to report 25 very, very similar bugs, and I used report templating, and it just saved so much freaking time.
Yeah, I will say, like, if you're not doing full-time bug bounty, like, and you don't need, like, need to be, like, submitting, like, a lot of reports, like, in mass like that, like, or if it's not something that you've, like, farmed, like, if your report, you're submitting 25 of the same report, template is a great solution for that. But if you're not a full-time bug bounty hunter, I don't think necessarily that, like, trying to shortcut the whole report writing process is a great idea, per se.
Even
like,
with
I think
AI?
It is kind of, like, I mean, to some extent, right? So, like, say you're not, like, a native English speaker, and you're like, I want to make sure, like, this is readable. I think that's a good use case for, like, I know, for example, HackerOne has, like, rewrite with HAI thing or whatever. You could maybe do that with ChatGPT or maybe Ollama, just to rewrite it and to make it more readable. But, like, having it generate and, like, write the report itself, at the end of the day, you're going to have to reread through it to make sure that it's actually right and that it actually got everything correct. And if you're doing that, then you're, like, halfway there pretty much to just writing the thing yourself.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel
and
like,
it is kind of part of the process. I don't know. I think it depends on what it is. Like, there should be sort of a line, I think, where, like, it makes sense to have the AI be writing a report for you versus just writing it yourself. Because, like, at what point do you, like, need the AI to write? Like, how much time is it saving you to, like, collect all this stuff, put it into the AI, read through what it writes, format that, like, you know, it's like, you're like probably 50% of the way there.
It helps, man. It helps. It does help.
Right?
I think for me, like, just seeing the way that it worked for my sample stuff that I wrote associated with this, I literally, like, took one request, one response, one two sentence, you know, thing about how to access this thing, and it extrapolated a bunch of the correct details. It's like,
what type of bug was it?
It was an IDOR. And there was another one for Reflected XSS. Worked great. And
that's pretty straightforward, though, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the use case where we're right now. I just don't feel like writing up these super annoying bugs, you know. And I just, like, okay, just send it off. All you have to do is just tell the triager, like, log into the application, go get this ID from here, and then do this, do that. And it actually did a really good job. This is the part that was surprising to me. The application that I gave it the test data from, it knew about that application. It's a pretty popular application. And it was like, oh, you know, this is the functionality in this application. You can get log in, go to this spot, and then do this thing. And I was like, oh, wow, that's, like, I didn't tell you about that. You just kind of knew that.
It's kind of weird that I knew
that. Kind of funky, you know, like, yeah. So I'm sure there will be problems with it. But I think for me, having to actually get out of my hacker brain and into my writer brain and start doing that, I think that will be, I think this will be a big time saver for me. So I've only used it, you know, a couple times, but I think it'll be helpful.
Yeah, right. It's like, yeah, for sure. I agree with you. I think, like, it depends on the use case. And, like, if you find that use case for yourself where, like, it makes sense and, like, it's something simple like that, or it's just, like, a big time saver where, you know, you don't have a template that fits it nicely or whatever. You can't just, like, copy paste the company name and it's not something in mass and it needs to be a little more custom, then, like, AI is great for that. Or, like, having something rewrite it for you with just, like, a little bit of info is great for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I wanted to shout out while we're at this segment, I wanted to talk a little bit more about Fabric as well, because Fabric is pretty rad. There's a couple other patterns that I use pretty regularly that come in here as well. The create command one in particular is great. So you can just say, like, echo, write me a command to, you know, a said command to, like, remove this or that or the other thing, and just pipe that into Fabric create command. And it will write that whole command for you. And I'm like...
pipe it together and stuff.
Yeah. And, like, get
and
it all
copy paste.
Built out.
That's
pretty
nice.
And it knows... I mean, you can give it more context too. You can give it more, like, the man pages or whatever and that sort of thing. And it will be able to tie stuff together. But for stuff where you're constantly trying to, like, what was that syntax or whatever? I think this is really handy. And the other ones, so there's clean text, which I think is a really interesting one. You can kind of tell it, give it some text, and it will try to pull out, like, all of these weird formatting things and try to get it in a very consistent format. And I think this is something that, you know, we've all become pretty adept with using, like, sed, grep, awk, you know, all these things to try to get the text in the right format. But for the beginner that is just trying to get stuff to be in the right format for like an intruder list or something like that.
Yeah.
I think this could be really helpful.
Dude, you know, I'm really conflicted about this whole thing because mm-hmm. this reminds me of the conversation that we had with Keith mm-hmm. about like the Google effect of this on memory and learning, where it's like, I do think it's worthwhile to like know how to use sed or know how to use awk or know how to like use these fundamental Linux commands mm-hmm. to modify and chain data and not just be like, let me ask the AI how to do this and just have like blindly copy pasting. It's like the equivalent of like, you know, Stack Overflow or whatever, like just like, you know, copy pasting code snippets and just not really knowing what you're doing. And I think like this is something like I want like things to be easier for people, but I also don't want to encourage like the wrong type of learning and behavior mm. around this, where like this should be something that you should be learning or using like as a utility to make your life easier, not to like do something you don't know how to do.
Yeah.
Necessarily. Well, there's like a line, right? Where like, you know, something's not worth your time. And then, okay, you probably shouldn't be wasting your time like learning this, but like learning how to use sed, like again, like I think like the fundamental Linux knowledge and stuff that you're going to gain off that is like so much more valuable and more applicable than like, for example, using it to write a report. Like you don't need to like go learn how to like write like a PhD student in order to write a report, right? You can just have like the AI do that for you. Mm. But you should learn what the Linux commands that you're using are doing.
There's a limit to that, right? Like we all have limits to our knowledge. I know how to use sed and awk and cut and all these things very, very fluently, but I don't know all of these super abstract edge cases for JQ or like, you know, some of these other applications, right?
But imagine if you did.
but I don't, you know, and I've got other things to do besides like, especially when you're this is a really important takeaway, I think. Especially when you're hacking, you want to try to remove as much friction as possible to you being able to get to your goal in the hacking scenario, right? So for things like this, yes, it's helpful to have that knowledge about sed and awk. And if you want to take the time to learn that outside of being in the zone from a hacking perspective, then that's great. But at the end of the day, when you're hacking, you need to stay in your flow and you need to remove as much friction as possible. So that's where I think stuff like Fabric and integrating these clean text or create command patterns could be really helpful, because it removes that now I got to go look at the docs, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And now I can just, okay, here's what I need to write, copy, paste it, and go. Your cat's tail is like right in front of this.
I was going to say, I think, you know, there is, right, there's like a line. I forgot what I was going to say now.
The cat.
I remember. Yeah. So like definitely I would recommend setting aside some time to be able to learn these things, right? Like don't always just say that like, in the effort of like going fast and like not getting out of flow, I'm not going to bother learning this thing. And then you'll like never learn it. I do think it's important to like set aside some time for yourself to learn these types of things. So if it's something that you don't want to learn now, but you think that you should learn later, put it in like a note file or something, and then like set aside like one day a week or something if you're a full-time hacker, or a couple hours per week or certain times a day where you can go and you can research those things and not feel the pressure to be hacking, but instead be learning to improve your hacking and hone it, you know?
Yeah. What I recommend to my mentees as well is doing that sort of supplemental learning during times when you can't deep focus on hacking. So let's say you've got an hour at this cafe while your kid's at their swim lesson or whatever, right? Take that hour, and instead of trying to like get into a target and in an hour and like find a bug, which you could, you know, it's possible, especially if you structure your time properly. But instead of that, maybe take some time, go learn all these commands, go learn about, go set up some environment that's going to save you some time and reduce your friction when you do have focus time, like 4 hours or something like that, where you can really be in the zone. That's sort of my recommendation.
Yeah. I also love doing that when I'm in constrained environments, like on a plane, on a train, traveling in an Uber. Like when you're in constrained environments and you're just like, what do I do? Instead of scrolling Twitter, go find an article and read through that article, because you're much more likely to actually read through it and occupy yourself than you are to like do that when you're at your computer and you have a million other things that you can be doing.
Yeah. And it doesn't make a difference just that one time, but if you get in the habit of doing it, like and you keep on getting in this habit of like, oh, let me read this article instead of scrolling Twitter, or let me like figure out how to use this Linux yep. command while I'm, you know, waiting in line at the grocery store or something like that, then that knowledge will compound, and you're just going to be mega elite at the end. you're going to yep, be the next absolutely. Tom Nom Nom.
absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, I guess on the note of like taking some time, biting the bullet and setting some stuff up, I do have a couple recommendations in addition
yeah,
to what we've mentioned here already. I always record a POC video. That's the first one. Like, unless it's literally click the link, see the pop-up, and even then, if it's going to be a bounty above like $500 or something like that, if it's a bounty that I'm going to be upset to lose, if like the endpoint goes down or something like that, I'm always going to record a POC video because it's so, it takes so little time. It shows proof that the thing happened, and it just makes it easier for these triagers that are skimming reports more and more nowadays. That's one tip. Always record a POC video. And two, remove friction to recording that POC video on yourself and make it a nice setup. You know, what I'm using nowadays is OBS, and I've sort of, I really like the way Loom has their setup in place, right? And I wish I could use Loom, but it sends the video out to Loom automatically, right? Which is kind of meh. So I kind of set up my OBS to mimic Loom, and I've got like a little circle of my face down at the bottom, and I've got, you know, the screen recording on there. And for some reason, my default setting on OBS, I don't know if you have this as well, Joel, but it didn't have a pause button by default. It was like something about the way that it's encoded.
I've got to check my OBS now.
Go check it, because it didn't have a pause button. And I was like, why does this not have a pause button? Because it's super helpful when you're recording a video to be like, okay, now I'm going to brute force this for 20 seconds. Be right back. And you just, you know, press the pause button, and then you come back when it's, you know, done brute forcing, and then you can show the result or whatever.
Yeah.
Do you have it?
No, I don't. Yeah. I don't think so. Unless I have to start recording, but yeah, that's.
Yeah, I think you might have to start recording with the like start recording button down at the bottom, before it can pop up. But I don't know if, because your camera and microphone are in use right now. I don't know if it can do it.
Oh yeah, I'm not gonna.
Don't mess with it. Don't mess with it. But here, if you don't have a record button, here's the way to get a record button on, not a record button, what am I saying? A pause button on your recordings for OBS. Go to settings, go to output, go to recording, and then change your recording encoder to X264 and change the output type to MP4 and then save it. And if you just Google it, there's an article on it. You know, of course, I just am telling you from the article. But essentially, that will give you the pause button, just with something with the way it does encoding. It can't pause with the normal encoding. And then that pause button will pop up, and you can easily pause, unpause, and you've got a nice little setup, and the triager can see you, and it makes a connection, and it's very easy to follow. So that's my tip there, is like, go ahead and set that up, and then reduce as much, you know, set the auto output directory to be somewhere where you know exactly where it is, and just reduce the friction as much as possible to doing these POC videos, and then just do it every time, and have a voiceover as well. Talk them through it. Say, okay, now we're going over here, we're clicking this button, then the attacker is like, you know, doing this thing, and just talk them through the whole flow. It will really help to understand the full attack vector, and it will get your reports through triage faster. And it will, even in scenarios, I've actually had triagers be like, hey, I can't reproduce this because of XYZ, but I see you have a video and I followed the video, so I'm going to triage this. And this just saves you that extra time bump, you know?
Yeah. One thing I will say about the videos. So if you can't embed your video in your report, like, don't, I wouldn't, because, like, for real, because making, whether it's the program, whether it's the triager, whoever, have to download your MOV file like run it on their, like, that should give everyone an ick.
Embed it.
Yeah, embed it in your report. Don't just attach it as a thing on the end and be like, attached is a video recording. Like, that literally just feels like a malware email that you've sent me. Like, please see the attached PDF file and run it on your computer.
Dude.
Like, bro.
The report is like, ability to social engineer security analyst into.
Right. Open up
the video. Proof I'm of like, concept. Hang on a you second. Just opened this.
Like, hang on a second. Yeah. I think I've seen this one before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can't imagine anybody doesn't know this, but on HackerOne and BugCrowd, you can embed the videos directly in the report, so that you have to do that.
And not only that, at least on HackerOne, there's a built-in screen recorder. So you don't use OBS, you don't have a screen recorder set up, there's a button you can click in the HackerOne webpage, like record my screen or whatever. You can record your screen. It automatically embeds it right in the thing. I don't know how well it works. I've never used it before.
I think
but
it's a little
there.
Funky.
And, give it a shot. If you don't like it, then you can go through the effort of setting up OBS or some recording software. Loom is super easy. Like you said, like Loom is great. Puts your face there, puts your mouse there. It's very user friendly. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of options.
Yeah. Loom, I've been using a lot recently for sending messages to you, sending messages to the other members of our staff. And then
yeah, Justin communicates to me with videos. He'll be like, hey man, are you around? I'm like, yeah. And then he'll just reply with like a video. I'm like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah, very true. Very true. Joel's like, hey man, what's your favorite color? And I just said to respond with a Loom link. Like,
it's like, hey, so as you can see, I'm a pretty big fan of this shade of red right here. But also this one's pretty good as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. But so let dang it, we are silly today, Joel. So regarding Loom, I did want to definitely add this though, that one, it's very helpful for sending like collaborating with other hackers. You can be like, hey, check out this request. It literally, you just press the record button, you record it, gets your mic, gets your, you know, little face down in the corner, it's recording your screen, follows your mouse, all those sort of things. And then literally the instant you press stop recording, it generates a link. Then you can just drop that link in a Discord chat or whatever, and it will, and your buddy can like follow along with you. Exactly. That's super helpful for collaboration. And here's what I've been doing with it recently that's been kind of a game changer, is when I've got to step away from work for the night or whatever, and I'm in my zone and I'm like, man, I wish I didn't have to leave. I'm like in my zone. Just recording a Loom video to myself and saying, hey, you think this request, I always do it in the second person, like, you think that currently you think that this is really
yelling,
you know,
at yourself.
Yeah, this is really weird and we should come back to this request. And that's been really helpful. And then I'll just kind of bookmark it and like put it right in an annoying spot in my bookmark bar, so I see it as soon as I open up my browser, and I watch that video, and that helps me drop right back into the flow state that I was in the last time that I was hacking. That's a big one, man. That one really helps.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that. I mean, that in combination with what Ron said he does, and I do this as well, where you try and leave yourself on like a cliffhanger the night before so that you're really energized to go hack that the next day. You know, that's always good to sort of set yourself up for success the next day and have something to look at and have something to focus on instead of just sitting down and being like, right? That momentum is like super important. So keeping the momentum going, like, across over throughout the evening by sending notes to yourself and keeping notes of what you were working on and where you were in that momentum headspace is really, really important.
I agree. Yeah, that was such a great tip from Franz. Like, I had such an extreme response to that. I was like, no, that's the moment that you gotta like that's when you crush the app into the ground.
That's what you have to,
you know. And no, it makes a lot of sense. You just leave it, you let your brain sort of reflect on it for the rest of the night or whatever. And then the next morning when you need to get up at, you know, 5 a.m. to go hack before your kids wake up, you wake up and your eyes are like this, you know, your eyes are kind of squinty, and then, you know, like, they just go wide open and you remember
and you're like,
let's go.
Oh, yeah. I gotta go hack that thing.
Exactly. It very real stuff there. Very
some
real
people
stuff.
Like their coffee in the morning. I like my,
yeah,
my last night realization.
Joel, what the frick, dude? Okay, okay. Couple more reporting tips, and then we're just gonna
it's
wrap.
Kind of putting the stuff at the end, otherwise yeah, we might weird people out.
Poor listeners this week, man. Yeah. So if this is your first episode of Critical Thinking that you're listening to, I'm so sorry. This is not how we normally are. Okay, so a couple more tips. Dude, I only just found out. I've been writing reports on HackerOne for 7 years at this point. I just found out recently that you can use syntax highlighting in your markdown blobs.
Yeah.
Recently, maybe like being like 2 years ago or something.
This isn't
like
just a HackerOne thing, by the way.
Yeah, this is a markdown thing.
Yeah.
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 Backtick, 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 and then whatever language, right? So there's one for HTTP, JS, JavaScript.
There's one for like everything. Yeah.
Dude, yeah. That is amazing.
It's amazing. And one of my favorite ones is HTTP.
Yeah.
Which is a much less well-known one, but it basically is great for highlighting HTTP requests, the headers and the body and that kind of stuff. It works especially well on HackerOne. I think they have some extra stuff added to it that makes it work nicer than it does in other places. But you can use this on Discord as well. If you're chatting with your friends on Discord,
amazing,
and you send them a code block instead of just some block of text, put the language there. Add some color to it. It's nice.
Stop it. Get some help.
It's like, get some help. Please. It's like a paint by numbers, you know? You can do it.
Oh my gosh.
All you have to do is just add the language.
Joel. Okay. All right. All right. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you this. Do you always, so just read the whole markdown situation. Do you always forget how to do a link in markdown, or is that like not?
It's now burned into my brain. I don't know.
Is it?
I just know that it's...
I don't know what my problem is with that, but I like always get it mixed up. So...
Here's a good way to think about it. If you were to send someone, if you were to write someone like,
right,
hey, here's this really interesting thing. What you would normally do is you would put in parentheses after that, the link.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Be like, hey, here's this thing, parentheses, link. Okay. So it's the same in Markdown. You just surround it in... telling it what
so
the
it's
link
like
should be.
It's square brackets and then parentheses adding the context, sort of like that sort of thing.
Yeah The link is like parentheses hidden and the square brackets are like link this thing.
Okay, could you say that all again but with a little ASMR, like
okay, so the first parentheses, you want to whisper the parentheses.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. No, that's burned into my brain now. That is helpful though. I think having that parentheses around towards the end, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay, dude, we got to wrap this episode because we're getting too loopy. let me just finish this out. Okay.
How many times can I derail Justin this episode?
No, dude, no, it's not just you, man.
I got to get a counter going. I'm going to get a world record.
Yeah. So last one that I wanted to say was screenshots are also very important in writing your reports. You should be including those on a really regular basis. And I know a lot of you are just using like the built-in, Windows screenshotter or whatever, or some like janky Linux one. I would recommend not doing that, even though I did that for a very long time and still sometimes do it because of muscle memory, and instead get something like GreenShot, where it's very simple. Like you activate it with a key binding, just like you do with, the Windows screenshotter. You can select very granularly. You know, it allows you to select down to the pixel. It's got a little magnifying thing that says, okay, from this pixel, you drag your size for the screenshot. And then you can pop it up into like a little screenshot editor where you can really easily like draw arrows and add text and stuff like that. And you're not like trying to draw and paint, like do this super jank looking circle and like this arrow that you drew with your mouse cursor. And
if you're on Windows, the best screenshot tool that I can ever recommend is called ShareX.
What?
ShareX.
Share, why don't you put X. these things in the dock?
Dude, I gotta keep these things. These are top secret.
Oh, wow. This looks
top
awesome.
Secret tips. ShareX. Yeah. I think it's Windows only, unfortunately, because it uses a lot of C#.NET stuff. I've tried to cross-compile it for Mac before because I liked it that much.
Wow.
But yeah, ShareX is really, really awesome. It allows you to add blur, arrows, rectangles, all sorts of really cool things. It has like bounding boxes and stuff. It just copies to your clipboard. You can do custom upload stuff. So like, if you wanted to just like send it to some API endpoint, if you have a custom image uploader,
no way,
you can do that. Yeah, you can do that. You can just have it copied to your clipboard, which is what I usually do.
Yeah.
But yeah, ShareX is really awesome. That's what I use on Windows for screenshots. On Mac, I just use the built-in screenshot thing. Preview is kind of okay. But if you want to add blurs and arrows, what I use is called Skitch. S-K-I-T-C-H on
Skitch.
Mac.
Interesting.
Skitch.
Let's add it, add that to the... I'll add it right now.
It looks like this software may or may not exist anymore.
Did it discontinue or something like that?
Skitch.
Does it have like a little...
I can find the CNET download links.
Hold on. I just put it in the section in the doc.
Did you?
Is that the one? It's got like a little arrow.
That is the one. Okay. Yeah, that's it. I don't know how you found that.
You know,
that's it.
Hacker skills, man. Google dorker.
Skitch. Yeah. This one's pretty good. Oh, yeah. It's made by Evernote. Yeah.
Oh, is it really? Oh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's one of the reasons I like it. So it's made by like pretty reputable company. So Evernote makes this, this image editor called Skitch. And you can add blurs. You can add little arrows to it. I think you could probably do it in Preview, just the Mac Preview app as well. But it's blurs. I don't know about that. But yeah, ShareX on Windows.
Okay, so that's your recommendation. My recommendation is GreenShot. I'm gonna go ahead, because you didn't tell me about this before the episode, Joel. I didn't get the chance to go and download it and install it and provide my official recommendation. But we can leave that up to the listener. GreenShot versus what was the one for what Windows that you recommended?
ShareX.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll see which one of those gets the better review from the community. Yeah. All right, dude. Is that a wrap? I think we're done, right?
I think that's a wrap.
All right, dude.
Good luck writing your reports, everybody.
Yeah. You got this. Go get it, guys. All right. Peace.
Peace.
Okay, yeah. So after playing around with it a little bit, Joel's screenshotting tool, ShareX, is way better. So ignore me. Don't use GreenShot. Use ShareX. It's open source. It's amazing. You're welcome.